Hi, my name is Donald Fines. I'm the staff historian here at Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. For the next few minutes, I'd like to take you on an architectural tour of Chatham. The tour consists of 7 stops and takes about 30 minutes to complete. At the end of each stop, simply turn off your player, move to the next stop, and then turn your player back on. We'll start our tour of Chatham on the front lawn, the side facing the river. When you reach the lawn, turn and face the house, and then restart your player. Chatham was built by William Fitzhugh between the years 1768 and 1771. Although only in his 20s at the time, Fitzhugh was already one of Virginia's wealthiest and most powerful men. This house was meant to be an expression of that wealth and power. Fitzhugh built his house on the bluffs overlooking Fredericksburg, Virginia. If you've ever visited Europe, you may have gone to a city or town overlooked by a castle. The nobleman who lived in the castle controlled the town, and everybody knew it. The same held true here at Fredericksburg. William Fitzhugh held the reins of power here, and Chatham's dominating presence, looking down on the town, reminded people of that fact. Fitzhugh built his home in the Georgian style of architecture common in the mid to late 18th century. The primary characteristic of Georgian architecture is its symmetry. If you were to draw a vertical line down the center of the house, the left side of a Georgian house would look exactly like the right side. And so it is with Chatham. Chatham was built with 24-inch thick brickwork laid in what was called Flemish bond. In Flemish bond, the long sides of the bricks, called stretchers, alternate with the short sides of the brick, called headers. In some cases, the short sides of the bricks were glazed, producing a darker, shinier appearance, giving the pattern a little bit more interest than it might otherwise have had. Chatham also employs rub brick. Rub brick was buffed with sandstone, giving it a smoother, lighter appearance. Builders used rub brick to accent the windows and corners of the house and the belt line that separates the top floor from the bottom. Chatham also has a water table located about 4 feet or so above the ground. Made of molded brick, the purpose of the water table is to project water running down the bricks away from the foundation of the house. Today, Chatham looks very much as it did in William Fitzhugh's time. One thing which isn't the same, however, is the shutters. Fitzhugh built the house with interior shutters. In other words, the shutters were located inside the windows and folded into the window jambs. You can see evidence of this inside the house. Sometime before the Civil War, however, the interior shutters were taken down and replaced by the current exterior shutters. In 1809, William Fitzhugh sold Chatham to a man named Churchill Jones, who updated the house by adding a classical revival porch here on the front of the building. If you step back from the house, you can see the ghost lines of where those porches once stood. The reason you can see those ghost lines is that the house was painted at different times in its history. At one point it was painted white, at another time it was painted red, and another time still it was painted mustard yellow. Over time the paints faded, and now Chatham, for the most part, exhibits the natural red brick color it had in Fitzhugh's day. Step back inside the house now, and while standing in the entry hall, turn your player back on. You are now standing in the entry hall. When you enter the house, the first thing you notice is that there is no central stairway. That's highly unusual in a house from this period. We don't know why Fitzhugh built it this way, but it did afford one great advantage. That is, it gave him one big room he could use for social occasions, such as neighborhood dances. However, you wouldn't have wanted to host one of those dances in the wintertime, because, as you can see, there are no fireplaces in the room, and it would have been very cold. The second thing you'll notice about the house is its narrow width. Throughout its length, the house is only one room wide. Such a design, while expensive, offered several advantages. First of all, it made the house appear much larger than it actually was. At the time of its construction, Chatham had just 9 rooms, but it looked much bigger. A second advantage to this narrow width is that it allowed light to enter the room from both sides, making them brighter and more cheery. That was especially important in the era before gas or electric lights. Finally, the one-room width allowed breezes to circulate freely through the building, a decided advantage during Virginia's long, hot summers. Before leaving the room, I'd like to point out 3 other features. The first is the high ceilings. Here, on Chatham's first floor, the ceilings are 12.5 feet high, which aided in the air circulation. On the second floor, the ceilings are 11 feet high. A second thing to notice is the color of the paint. Chatham's rooms originally were white with dark green trim. However, for a brief period in the early 1800s, this hallway was painted salmon, the color you see today. Finally, take a look at the doorways leading into the adjacent rooms. Notice that the passages are not only different in size, but different in their relative locations on the walls. The larger north doorway is in the center of the wall, while the opening for the smaller south door is near the end of the wall. Because Georgian-style houses were symmetrical, both inside and out, this suggests that at some point one of these doorways was modified. In fact, both were. When the house was first built, the larger north doorway was probably the same size as the smaller south doorway and stood directly across from it. At some point in the 19th century, however, both openings were significantly widened and moved to the center of their respective walls. Years later, the owners restored the smaller south door to its original size and location and reduced the width of the larger north door, resulting in the configuration you see today. At this time, proceed through the smaller south door into what was once the dining room. The location of this room, adjacent to the butler's pantry, identifies it as the dining room. The pantry lies just behind the swinging door to the left of the fireplace. Feel free to take a peek into the room, but please don't enter it without a docent. The fireplace is not original to the house, having been added sometime before 1927. However, the paneling above the fireplace and the ornate cornice that runs along the top of the walls are original. Throughout Chatham's history, this wall would have been painted, but we have purposely removed the paint so that you can see the wooden pegs that held the panels in place. Some of Chatham's paneling was torn off and burned by Union soldiers during the Civil War, exposing the plaster walls beneath, on which soldiers then scrawled graffiti. For an example of this, walk over to the left window facing the garden. On either side of the window, you'll see examples of Union graffiti. Later owners covered the graffiti with new boards, but the National Park Service has purposely removed them in order to again expose it. We'll see another example of graffiti at our next stop, the morning room. To reach the morning room, return to the center hall and continue through the house until you come to a small furnished room on your right. You're now standing in what used to be a stair hall, one of two small chambers that featured stairs leading to the second floor. The other stair hall was in the southern end of the house, just beyond the dining room. Face the window. The stairway here ran along the right side of the room, proceeding upwards towards the far wall to a landing. There it turned 180 degrees and continued on to the second floor. The stairway also provided access to the basement, which ran along the entire length of the house. Owner James Horace Lacey removed the staircase prior to the Civil War and added the wall behind you, turning this area into a morning room, where he could enjoy the sunlight that poured through the window early in the day. If you look carefully at the floor underneath the sofa, you can see where Lacey patched the opening that led to the basement. At the same time Lacey removed this stairway, he added the butler's pantry in the southern end of the building and replaced the stairway there with the one that currently exists. Before leaving this room, take a look at the small frame section of wall near the end of the sofa. While repairing this wall in the 1990s, National Park Service personnel discovered the signature of Sergeant Sylvester Ostrander scribbled on the plaster below. Ostrander was shot through the lung during the Battle of Fredericksburg and was treated in the house before being sent to a hospital in the northern states. He, like many other Union soldiers, left his mark on Chatham's walls. Return now to the center hallway, where you first entered the house, and then exit by the left door into the garden. Chatham was more than simply one building. It was a plantation encompassing upwards of a dozen buildings, big and small. Among the structures here in the 18th century were smokehouses, storehouses, a dairy, a laundry house, a kitchen, a spring house, a barn large enough for 36 cattle, a granary, stables for 30 horses, an ice house, an overseer's house, a gristmill, and quarters capable of housing 50 slaves. Of those many buildings, just two remain, the kitchen and the laundry. As you face the garden, the kitchen building is on your right. In true Georgian style, it's mirrored by the laundry building, visible to your left. Both buildings required constant fires, either for cooking or for heating water with which to wash clothes. The two buildings were purposely kept apart from the main house, both to reduce the chance of fire destroying the main building and to lessen the heat and noise there. In the years following the Civil War, Chatham transitioned from a plantation to a landed estate. As the 20th century dawned, the porches, then a century old, were removed and this became the front of the house. Over this period, the functions of the kitchen and the laundry building also changed. The kitchen moved to the basement of the main house after the Civil War, and the old kitchen building was transformed into a servant's residence. The owners added a second story to the kitchen at that time, as well as dormer windows and a slate roof. The laundry building, too, changed function. Under the divorce, it became a guest house, while Chatham's final owner, John Lee Pratt, used the building as his office. The DeVores added this magnificent garden in the 1920s. Mrs. DeVore, who was an avid gardener herself, hired Ellen Biddle Shipman, the foremost female landscape architect of her day, to design the garden, which included a rose garden, a columned pergola, and the globe-like orrery, or sundial, visible to your right, not to mention several fine pieces of statuary. To heighten the exotic effect, peacocks strutted the grounds at will, showing off their plumage and breaking the silence with their harsh calls. To ensure privacy, Mrs. DeVore built a 7-foot-high wall around the garden. Outside the wall, however, Chatham remained a working farm. To see where much of the work was done, proceed through the opening in the wall to your right into what is now the employee parking lot. In the 20th century, Chatham employed perhaps a dozen workers, a far cry from the 50 to 100 slaves who worked on the plantation prior to the Civil War. The house servants, the butler, cook, and maids, were black workers. Those who worked on the farm and on the grounds, by contrast, were white workers. You're now standing in what was known as the yard, the portion of the estate where much of the outdoor work was done. Stand so that you are facing the large green gate. To your right is the old kitchen building, which by the 20th century was the residence of Chatham's butler. Opposite the kitchen, on your left, is the watchman's office. Built around 1900, this building provided shelter for the night watchman, who roamed the grounds between dusk and dawn every night, warding off potential burglars. Lillian Pratt had an extensive collection of fine jewelry, including 5 Easter eggs produced for the Russian imperial family by renowned jeweler Peter Carl Fabergé. It's no wonder, then, that the Pratts felt the need for a little extra security. Attached to the watchman's office was the well house. In the years before Chatham was connected to the city water system, well water was stored, heated, and purified here. Later owners installed a furnace in the well house that provided central heating for the estate, and it was here that electricity entered the grounds and was monitored. To the left of the watchman's office are 2 bays where vehicles were kept. Note the original blue paint on the inside of the building. Also note the large brick dovecote perched above the left end of the building. Turn around now and stand with the dovecote on your right and the kitchen and the watchman's office behind you. To the left of the watchman's office are 2 open bays where vehicles were kept. Behind it is a stable for 6 horses, and above the stable, a hayloft. The stable was built by Daniel DeVore, who, being an ex-army officer, probably kept at least 1 horse for riding. Horses used to pull the farm's plows and wagons found shelter here as well. Walk through the gatepost near the stable and proceed to the caretaker's house at the end of the drive. On the way, you'll pass a gas pump dating from the 1930s and a corn crib that is more than 100 years old. A bell situated in the cupola on top of the corn crib was used to summon workers from the fields. We'll learn more about those workers at our next stop. You should now be standing in front of a modest white house situated near Chatham's front gate. Off to your left is the visitor parking lot, and beyond that, one of several fields that have comprised Chatham since the 1700s. Chatham was a working farm throughout its 200-year history. Its final owner, John Lee Pratt, acquired all the land between here and Falmouth, 1 mile away. Farmers hired by the DeVores and the Pratts cultivated much of this land. One of the farmers lived in a house just across the fields to your left. A second farmer occupied a very flimsy structure on the site just ahead of you. When the Pratts purchased the property in 1931, they tore down this ramshackle building and constructed the house that you see today. In the late 1930s, when General George C. Marshall paid John Lee Pratt a visit here at Chatham, he and his wife stayed overnight in this building. The Pratts, too, were residents here for a time. John Lee Pratt served on the War Resources Board, and during World War II, he and his wife moved into the house to save energy, presumably as a patriotic gesture rather than to save money. For most of its brief history, however, this building was the home of Chatham's head gardener, who supervised the staff that maintained the gardens and the grounds that we enjoy today. This concludes our tour. I hope you have enjoyed our brief stroll through Chatham's history. To learn about other podcasts available at this park, inquire at Chatham's front desk or talk to a ranger at either the Fredericksburg or Chancellorsville Battlefield Visitor Centers.